We're joined now by the publisher and leader of the crescent-online.net. Are you there, Zafar?
Hello, Phil. Yes, I think you've been so busy you even forgot who I am. Huh?
I forgot who you are. Let me see. Well, I started at A, and you know you come at Z. So I try to talk about too many subjects in one day. We're very glad to have you because there is now a ceasefire.
Yes.
And it is. It appears to be under the responsibility of these two powers, Russia and the U.S., who don't really like each other that much. But I've read your comments on the developments there and in Crescent-Online. It looks to you, I believe you think it will hold. Do you want to talk about why that is?
Yes. Basically, when Russia and the U.S. are on the same page, in this case, of course, the U.S. has finally come to the point or the realization that the policy that it was pursuing with respect to overthrowing the government of President Bashar al-Assad, that it is no longer an option, and that the Russian bombing campaign that was launched on September the 30th of 2015 has been so effective against the terrorist groups that are backed by Saudi Arabia, Turkey, as well as, incidentally, the U.S. And Jordan, Qatar, etc., that the Americans realized that if there weren't a ceasefire and to freeze everything on the ground, that the Russian bombing campaign, together with the Syrian army advances, as well as their allies, Hezbollah and Iranian advisors, that they were going to flush out all of these terrorists completely out of Syria. And so the U.S. decided that it should opt for the ceasefire option. Now, it's a limited ceasefire option. It is only valid for 2 weeks. But there is hope that if this holds for the two-week period, then obviously it would lead to serious political discussions. And the U.S. has said that 69 of the various groups that it has influence with have agreed to the ceasefire. And I think your listeners should note that there are other groups outside this list of 69 groups. So you have a very, very vast array of groups that are involved there. There are only two caveats that I'd like to add, and both have, of course, emerged since the ceasefire went into effect. The first is that the Turks have continued to shell areas inside Syria. They, of course, the bee in their bonnet is, of course, the Kurds. The YPG, and they simply cannot accept that the Kurds would be let go or they should have a free hand, even in Syria. Of course, the Turks are attacking them inside Turkey. And the second caveat is that the Saudis, Saudi foreign minister issued a statement, and he said that if the ceasefire does not hold, then the plan B that John Kerry had mentioned a couple of days ago with respect to partitioning Syria should come into play, and the Saudis are pushing for that. Mm-hmm. Now, both Turkey and Saudi Arabia have lost in this arrangement because they want to see continued chaos and turmoil in Syria. They don't want peace. The Saudis continue to insist that Bashar al-Assad should go. Even John Kerry said that there can only be peace in Syria with the departure of Bashar al-Assad. Now, of course, this is such a silly statement. It is not for John Kerry or anybody else outside Syria to decide. This must be decided by the Syrian people. And the Syrian people had given their opinion in mid-2014, in June of 2014. They elected President Bashar al-Assad with an overwhelming vote. And now we know that once the ceasefire announcement was made, President Bashar al-Assad announced that there will be parliamentary elections in Syria in mid-April of this year. Obviously, it's a very, very ambitious plan.
By the way, they're signing up people today, aren't they?
Yes, exactly. It's a very ambitious plan, but if we see that the ceasefire is holding relatively well within the next 2 weeks, because it just started on February 27th, midnight time, Damascus, so we are into it approximately 2 days. And so far, it's in terms of the groups, etc., they are holding their fire. And even Russia has announced that it was halting its aerial bombing campaign in order to give the ceasefire an opportunity as well as peace a chance. So I think let's see what happens over the next week or so. The picture would become much clearer then as we progress.
Yeah. We're speaking to Zafar Benkesh, who, by the way, is the author of The Doomed Kingdom of the House of Saud. It's just a very happy book to read. Everybody should get a copy of that. They've agreed that this has to do. This is under the rubric of UN resolution. Is it 2254?
That's correct. Yes.
This is what 2254 is, the roadmap. So what's in 2254?
Basically. That resolution endorsed the agreement that was reached at Geneva, and that was that there should be a ceasefire as well as a political solution to the problem or the war in Syria. And there was absolutely no mention that President Bashar al-Assad has to resign. So that was, you know, one of the points that the Americans were pushing for, but Russia, China, and of course supported by Iran and a number of other countries, they said that that's a non-starter, that it simply cannot.
It's a violation of the UN Charter, isn't it? I mean, it can't begin. It's just as outrageous.
Exactly. So, you know, they once that condition was dropped, then of course there was no problem with respect to the passage of this resolution, which was passed on December the 18th, and they just continued from there. And we have, of course, arriving at the February 22nd announcement jointly by the Russians and the Americans regarding the ceasefire. Now, I'm sure if your listeners have been following the news carefully, they would have noted that a week or 10 days prior to that, the Russians had announced that they will agree to a ceasefire by the 1st of March. And so what has transpired is sort of pretty close to that. It occurred on February the 27th, 2 days before the March 1st deadline. But in any case, that situation has now emerged, and it seems, I mean, I would express guarded optimism. I cannot say that I'm 100% certain that this would hold, but definitely there is guarded optimism because a number of the groups that are fighting against the Syrian government have also realized that if fighting continued, that they would lose more, and therefore whatever little that they can gain, they probably would be able to gain through a political settlement. And in fact, I would say that whatever has been agreed to now was available to these political groups as far back as 2012, 2013, that the Syrian government had announced that it was prepared to sit down with these groups to hammer out a political solution, to open political space to all political parties and groups and factions. Everybody can participate for the larger good of Syria. And unfortunately, their foreign sponsors were not interested at that time because they thought that, like Colonel Gaddafi in Libya, that they could overthrow the government and as put a puppet of their liking. Now, we know that Libya is in a mess. It's in total chaos. There is absolutely no stable government. There are, in fact, multiple governments. People are killing each other. Tribes are at each other's.
And now they have a new idea, return the king.
Yeah. Well, they keep on floating that periodically when they run out of options. You see, if you can't think of anything else, then they say, oh, let's bring the king.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, that won't work.
Yeah. This is Zafar Bengash, crescent-online.net. And Zafar, there is a kind of sensitive issues that were also spelled out in previous agreements. I have to ask you, sovereignty and the territorial integrity of Syria are guaranteed, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. In fact,
I understand the Americans are trying to wobble on that, but they can't.
Correct. Exactly. It is spelled out in the Geneva Agreement, and yet, incredibly, John Kerry was then talking about, just before the ceasefire agreement came into force, he was talking about a Plan B, which actually he referred to as the partition plan of Syria, that it will be partitioned along ethnic lines. And I also want to point out that that the Israeli Prime Minister, Netanyahu, at the World Economic Forum at Davos, had in fact mentioned the Balkanization of Syria. In fact, he had said in an interview with CNN, he had said, this was on January the 21st, he had said that the best outcome for Syria would be the Balkanization of Syria. And this is what is now being echoed by John Kerry during his testimony to the Congress, talking about Plan B, basically, again, Balkanization of Syria and splitting it into two, three ethnic enclaves, whatever, a similar plan being talked about. But I think I see Kerry's statement more as sort of a threat being issued to Syria or the Syrian government rather than a reality, because as you mentioned, that the Geneva Agreement called for respecting the sovereignty of Syria, and even in the ceasefire agreement, the sovereignty of Syria is specified, that it should be, and its territorial integrity should be respected.
I want to ask you, too, about some of these states you're outlining. Turkey has a problem. Israel has a problem. Mr. Erdogan, speaking of him, if this agreement goes through, all of his bluster and bluffing and noise, he's going to have a little blowback problem politically within Turkey, isn't he? I mean,
absolutely. I mean, he's facing a very serious problem and challenge inside Turkey. The opposition groups are up in arms, and I think even within the Turkish military, I believe there is a great unease at the manner in which Erdogan has proceeded with his policy, because it has totally failed. I mean, this could not be put in more stark terms. He just kept on digging himself into a hole, and he just refuses to stop digging. I mean, I don't know who his advisors are or why he is unable to see that whatever he set out to do in Syria has totally failed. I think he suffers from some kind of a megalomania that he thinks that he can revive the kingship in Turkey, and he would be the new sultan, whatever. But I mean, he wasn't that bad until about 5-6 years ago. But sometimes, unfortunately, people get carried away by their own self-importance and their own rhetoric, and then they become prisoners of that. So I think Erdogan seems to have become the prisoner of his own megalomaniac ambitions, and it is causing deep, deep problems and troubles for Turkey itself, because he's taking on too many people. He's taking on Russia, he's taken on Syria, he's taking on the Kurds, and of course he has upset a lot of his neighbors. He had started off with, when he became the prime minister back in 2003, that Turkey would have a zero problem policy with its neighbors. Today, Turkey has zero friends in the neighborhood.
A brilliant strategist.
Absolutely.
I think a Lebanese journalist, Sharmeen Narwani, has given a quite an interesting interview in which she says, whether anybody wants it or likes it or not, there's a new power arrangement, and Iran is not a, you know, is not only holding its own, has become now a power at the table when anybody talks about the region.
Absolutely. It was a beautiful, beautiful interview that that she gave to Javan newspaper in Iran, and I read it. I was very impressed by it. I mean, her depth of knowledge, her understanding of the issues and the way she framed them, they were absolutely brilliant. In fact, I would recommend your listeners to definitely read that interview. It is a wonderful, wonderful interview. You know, it really explains things in a very beautiful way. Yes.
Yeah. And apropos of that we, of course, just had an election, I better ask you quickly what your assessment of the Iranian elections is.
Well, a couple of points. Number one, that, you know, the elections were held in a totally free and fair manner. Everybody was allowed to participate in them. There was no violence. There was no rigging. Nothing of that sort took place at all. Everything went smoothly. Secondly, that there were two elections, one to the Majlis, which is the parliament, the 290-member body, and also there was the election to the Assembly of Experts, which is the upper body made up of scholars, etc. Now, in the Majlis elections, nobody has emerged the winner in the sense that no particular group dominates the Majlis. Although some of the people that are commonly referred to as reformists, although I don't like to use that word, these are actually people that are aligned with President Hassan Rouhani. They have made some gains in Tehran, but the other group, their opponent group, which is called the principalists, they have made major gains in the rest of the country.
Huh.
Now, Tehran has always been sort of, you know,
yes,
separate from the rest of the country in the sense that it is a big city, 12 million people, but Iran's population is 80 million. So obviously, and there are 55 million eligible voters in the country. So you have a, you know, the rest of the country has a very different outlook on these things. So as far as the parliament is concerned, no group has a complete dominance in parliament. Of course, the Assembly of Experts is a very different body, that it is made up of experts, as the name suggests. And, of course, this body is charged with electing the new leader whenever the need arises. And every year they, of course, oversee the conduct of the leader and make sure that he is acting according to the constitution and so on.
Yeah. I'm really glad to hear that analysis, and it's particularly striking, isn't it, that only a few years ago the U.S. was talking about how they're going to remove that government.
Absolutely.
And I think they cracked a molar trying. Saffar Bengash, it's a great pleasure talking to you.
It's my pleasure, Phil.
Look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
That's Saffar Bengash, crescent-online.net, and he's also author of The Doomed Kingdom of the House of Saud. Keep your eye on that, and you should get that book. I want to thank Robin Philpott and, of course, Dr. Tejan Rudasingwa for being our guests. And Lucas, thank you. And this is Phil Taylor, CIUT. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. We don't mind hearing from you. And we'll see you next week.